So one important thing is to, when you're thinking about a redistribution program, is to sort of think about who's empowered to make decisions. This is a profound question in the United States, where by the 1930s already, when you look at the New Deal, when the federal government has large plans to implement, they're looking around and they're saying, you know, what kinds of institutions do we have in the United States that have administrative capacity, that have large scale scope, that could actually implement a large program? And because of the nature of US policymaking and US history in the 19th century, what they have are industrial corporations, business associations, and the military. It's a profound problem and an enduring one in US society, the difficulty of actually constructing the kinds of institutions that could, in a more egalitarian way, actually carry out some kind of redistributive policy or even a growth policy that would have, you know, less inegalitarian possibilities.
Welcome to Reviving Growth Keynesianism, a podcast about economic thought from the mid-20th century and why it matters to us today. Our goal is to fan the flames of a growing conversation on inequality, growth, and aggregate demand, so that we may hopefully arrive at a place of better well-being for all.
Hi, I'm your co-host, Nick Johnson, and I'm coming to you today from the University of Chicago's Center for Spatial Data Science.
My name is Chris Hong. I'm a PhD student at the University of Chicago Department of History, and I'm an intern at the Center for Spatial Data Science.
And I'm your co-host, Robert Manduca, coming to you from the Department of Sociology at the University of Michigan. Thanks for joining us.
All right, so today we are joined by Amy Offner, Associate Professor in the Department of History at the University of Pennsylvania. Amy, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, glad to have you. I'm really excited to talk about your book, Sorting Out the Mixed Economy, because I've been wrestling with a lot of the ideas since it came out. It's a really kind of monumental and impressive work that takes us from the Depression and Colombian attempts to build a developmental state through the Great Society and the transformations of American social policy. Through the work, you track the rise of management, economics as professions, gold professions. So there's a lot here. There's a lot to unpack. And it's social history, it's cultural history, it's political history, it's economic history. It sort of does everything. So we're going to have to sort of ease our way into it. But before we do that, I was wondering if you could maybe give listeners a sense of who you are and your background and how you got interested in history.
Sure. Thanks for those kind words. Well, I think of myself as a historian of political economy, and my research has to this point been focused on the Americas. But I guess that was sort of an unexpected outcome for me in some ways, not entirely unexpected, but what you find among, I think, all historians is that the path that you take to a book is so winding and so circuitous that it only makes sense in retrospect. So I'll try to maybe do some bad history here by selecting out little bits of my life that I think explain where the book came from, although I don't think that in the moment I knew where I was going. I mean, I would say that the sort of politics of the book are certainly a product of just the way that I was raised. I grew up in a family that talked politics, and the history of the labor movement, the history of the old left and the new left, the history of US imperialism and resistance to US imperialism were just part of the sort of history of my own family and the conversations that I was surrounded by when I was growing up. I went to college in the late 90s, and I was at that point, what I was able to study in college that was sort of politically meaningful to me was the Black freedom struggle. And so that was sort of the area of historical research that I got a little bit immersed in as an undergraduate. And at the same time, I was getting involved in labor activism. What drew me in actually was a campaign to win a living wage for workers on campus who had been facing union busting and outsourcing and really deliberate attempts by the university administration to really destroy their power and living conditions for a very long time. And this was a moment when that kind of campaign was, first of all, happening on college campuses all around the country. And it was part of a much wider kind of left-wing political mobilization in the United States that was associated with also, you know, on college campuses, mobilization to address the fact that, you know, university apparel was being produced in sweatshops and to get universities to become actually a block that could actually raise conditions in factories actually abroad by adopting codes of conduct. There were wider mobilizations around, protesting at, every meeting of the Bretton Woods institutions and the World Trade Organization. The global justice movement was sort of a big part of my political education. And after I graduated, I went and worked as a union organizer, and I also worked at Dollars and Cents magazine, which is a left-wing political economy magazine and book publisher. And my job there was actually to edit classroom books that were used in college economics classes to introduce schools of thought and perspectives that had been edited out, really kind of censored out of economics textbooks over the last half century in the production of what today is kind of a standard neoclassical textbook. And sort of that work, which was not my kind of academic training, but all of that kind of political world that I was part of, I became interested in. First of all, that was where I encountered the concept of neoliberalism as a way of understanding kind of the discrete, apparently discrete, but evidently connected sort of problems that we were dealing with. The fact that, Paul Krugman was, a big apologist for sweatshops, and Jeff Sachs was architect of structural adjustment, and meanwhile at home the Clinton administration is destroying welfare and making it far more punitive and harsh. We were sort of looking at kind of what had happened to the labor movement, and the concept of neoliberalism became a way of kind of thinking about these problems with kind of respectable liberalism in that moment. And it also, within the left, this is not, this is before all of the kind of historical literature got published, right? This is a moment where kind of within the left and within left publications, there was actually writing and conversation about kind of where the neoliberal order had come from. And the story that I encountered at that time was a kind of an early version of the story that today is actually has been really developed in great depth and great insight by many scholars who focus on particular intellectual communities, mostly on the right, that spent decades across the post-war period as dissenting outsiders to socialism, to welfare states, to developmental states, to anti-colonial movements, and the argument was that basically in the moment of crisis of the 1970s, they had kind of seized that crisis used it to basically institutionalize a set of ideas and practices that had previously been incredibly marginal, that had really no wider sanction in really any of the societies that they were trying to transform, and that the world we lived in was sort of a product of that kind of intellectual and political coup from the right. That profoundly shaped my understanding of the world, and I think is still those ideas. Still, I think about them all the time. And when I went to graduate school, then that kind of those sorts of questions were on my mind. I was thinking about the origins of neoliberalism, and I was also thinking about the kind of social movement history that I had studied in college. And so I applied to graduate school to work in U.S. labor history and African American history. And one of the things that I found in graduate school that was really great, actually, was grad school should be an educational experience. You should come out different than you come in. I was really encouraged to spread out. So interests that I had, for instance, in Latin America that really just came from my political life growing up and political work that I had done before grad school, I was able to actually acquire some scholarly background in studying Latin America. Interest that I had in economic thought and the questions I had about kind of the authority of economists, which I had really been thinking about actually when I was involved in labor organizing, where economists were often, and economic arguments were often the kind of sort of the first line of offense, I would say, that were used by employers actually to stave off demands for social justice. And I also had been thinking about how economic knowledge had been actually shaped politically over time when I was editing classroom books. So those kinds of questions I started to be able to incorporate. And just one of the things that I found in grad school is that when you're trying to arrive at a dissertation topic, you meet a question that you really don't know the answer to, if it's going to sustain your attention for many, many years and be, you know, just intellectually rewarding. And I found that when I thought about U.S. labor history and African American history, I was very persuaded by a lot of the new social history. I still love it. And I actually found that some of my convictions about those subjects were just too strong, actually. I didn't have a terrific question that I really didn't know the answer to. Now, that might have been a failure of imagination on my part, but I found that by shifting my focus a little bit, I was able to come up with questions that I really didn't know the answer to. And so the book project kind of grew out of a very kind of unexpected way of kind of synthesizing interest that I had in the relationship between the US and Latin America, questions I had about the origins of neoliberalism. And then I think that that kind of orientation to the study of social movements, well, I would not say that this is a social history. The book, I don't think turned out that way. I do think it's a book that tries to answer broad questions about political economic change and about transnational history, crossing scales. So it's a book that at times, you know, operates at very high levels, looking at kind of high politics and intellectual life, but also tries to sink down into local land conflicts, that tries to look at sort of the people who lived in housing projects, that tries to look at the ways that social movements were trying to transform politics. And I do continue to think of social conflict as really the engine of historical change. And so I hope that that interest kind of is expressed in the book. And ultimately that the book, you know, sort of makes two arguments that are like the end point of you know, how I came to, I guess, think a little differently about the questions that I came in with. And one argument that the book makes is that, you know, first of all, it's an argument about the way that ideas and practices moved between the US and one Latin American country, Colombia, during this period from 1945 into the late 20th century. And I'm looking at how the sort of rise and fall of the US welfare state and the rise and fall of Colombia's developmental state were conjoined processes. And so one of the arguments I'm making is that we should analyze the United States as an American society, as a product of the self-same historical processes that produced Latin American republics and that has been racked, you know, really ever since independence by the exact same debates, problems, tensions that have racked Latin American societies, and that they've actually grown up through exchange with one another. And so we can think of Latin America not just as being shaped by the United States, but Latin America also as a place that shaped the United States. So that's one argument of the book. And the second argument of the book is about the origins of neoliberalism. And the book makes the case that first of all, we can reformulate that question, and rather than kind of ransack the past for the roots of the order that exists by the late 20th century, that we should look back at the order that preceded the neoliberal order, the welfare and developmental states of the mid 20th century. And when we look at how they were built and then how they came undone, what we find is actually that they contained enormous contradictions within them. And in fact, they contained a great many practices that we think of today as neoliberal inventions. And so I came to think of neoliberalism actually as a parasitic formation that appropriated and redeployed some of the key elements actually of the order that it destroyed. So I would say that kind of at the end of the story, or when I finished the book, I mean, my politics just hadn't changed, but my understanding of kind of the making of neoliberalism had really changed as I looked more carefully at the worlds that neoliberalism had overtaken and destroyed.
There's so much to dig into in that answer. I'm really curious about those educational materials that you were curating back in the 90s. I am also curious to always ask historians which chapter came first, if there was a singular sort of archive that you dove into that then sort of snowballed into the rest of it, or was it these big questions that you just started to approach the whole thing simultaneously?
When I started on this project, I probably would have told you that what I was studying were anti-poverty programs in the United States and Colombia. I was trying to think about the formation of the U.S. welfare state outside of a kind of nationalist exceptionalist framework. The rise and fall of the U.S. welfare state is clearly part of a transnational process where there are governments, you know, in the wake of the Great Depression all over the world trying to deal with poverty conceptualized in various ways in all sorts of ways. You get the growth of different kinds of developmental states, you get the growth of different kinds of welfare states. They rise and fall more or less simultaneously all around the world all at the same time. And so I wanted to understand how Latin American developmentalism and the US welfare state kind of could be understood actually as sort of growing and declining concurrently and in contact with each other. And I decided to focus my research in Latin America on Colombia for a whole bunch of reasons. Basically, Colombia was a huge crossroads for international lending, for international economic advising, and for all sorts of institutions in the mid-20th century. And many development theorists thought that it was actually a model of capitalist development in the third world. And so I decided to focus on Colombia because it was so richly connected to not just the United States, but the Bretton Woods institutions and other parts of Latin America in the third world. And so I didn't start with a particular chapter, but what I did is I went and did as much kind of preliminary research as I could in Colombia to identify what I thought would be some propitious kind of examples of developmentalist projects that were crossroads where I could explore the adaptation of ideas and the movement of ideas, as well as social conflict between what I love about anti-poverty programs and development programs is that by their nature, they're social crossroads. So, you know, housing, it involves, you know, high level planning, and it also involves people actually living there. and people, there's all sorts of conflicts that come from that. And so what I initially did is I identified several areas of Colombian statecraft where there were kind of massive important projects. So I look at the creation of Colombia's first regional development corporation and the agrarian reform of 1961 that is an important part of the Alliance for Progress, which was the anti-communist inter-American development program launched during the Kennedy administration to counter the example of the Cuban Revolution. I look at the creation of the largest housing project in Latin America built under the Alliance for Progress. And I look at the creation of new economics and management programs at Colombian universities that were supposed to produce new professions, new kinds of expertise that would steer the state and rationalize economic life. So when I was beginning the project, for me, because my training had been actually primarily in US history, I had a lot of remediation to do, both in Colombian history, and I had to sort of spend some time thinking about, you know, which aspects of the Colombian developmental state I wanted to focus on. And then from there were so many connections to the United States that what came later was a process of thinning out, actually, and selecting which connections to the United States I would focus on.
Yeah, that's great. And we're definitely going to be diving into some of the specific parts of the Colombian segment of the book further down the line. But I was wondering, and you mentioned how mid-century moment, Colombia is really held up as an example of Latin American development, which might be surprising for listeners who are perhaps only familiar with the recent decades of Colombian history. I was wondering if you could give a sense, and because the sort of post-1945 political and social history of Colombia, including periods of extreme instability and violence, are so important for both the mise-en-scène of the first half of the book and for the specific figures on the ground that you talk about. So I was wondering if you could give a sense of, the political developments from 1945, perhaps to the 60s and 70s, kind of where you end in the Colombian story.
Colombia today is regarded as a place that you would only study if you wanted to understand drugs, violence, and security policy. And in fact, that was my image, actually, of Colombia. And the reason I was so surprised when I realized it would be a good place to do research on very, very different questions. Countries get typed in certain ways, and it happens politically, and it also happens through, actually, the academy. And there's always stories to tell, actually, that violate our stereotypes. In the mid-20th century, Colombia was Colombia is one of the big states, one of the large states of Latin America. And for that reason, it was one of actually a pretty small number of states in Latin America that consistently and successfully pursued import substitution industrialization. Colombia also, in addition to that, was regarded by, as I said, many international development theorists as a model of capitalist development and liberal democratic reform. And that has to do with the fact that the Colombian government from 1958 to 1974 was governed by what was called the National Front. And this was a power sharing agreement between the two main parties that had actually ruled Colombia since the mid 19th century, the liberal and conservative parties. And they were trying to do away with both the left, the anti-capitalist left, and the authoritarian right. They had been, you know, really in power since the mid 19th century. But there was an extraordinary wave of political violence called La Violencia. And it's so extraordinary, simply known as the violence, that begins in the late 1940s and extends into the 1950s. And people date the end of La Violencia in different ways. There are parts of the country that continue to experience it actually into the early 1960s. And this was an extraordinary wave of political violence that functioned actually through the party system. And for that reason, it profoundly discredited, in the late 1940s and early 1950s, profoundly discredited these two political parties that in some ways actually resembled like the two-party system in the United States, very long-standing, very stable, kind of centrist series of parties. And so the result was that in Colombia, you actually had a brief period of military dictatorship this is the dictatorship of Gustavo Rojas Pinilla from 1953 to 1957. And this was a dictatorship that came to power saying basically these parties have failed, actually, the democracy itself has come to crisis, and that this dictatorship can actually restore order and prosperity, make Colombia peaceable again. In order to get out of that circumstance, the liberal and conservative parties kind of reformed themselves. And so in 1958, what they do is they bring into being a new power sharing agreement that divides all national offices evenly between the two parties. They're trying to eliminate the kind of explosive and violent dimension of partisan conflict. So they agreed to evenly divide all offices between them, to rotate the presidency between them, so they'll alternate for 16 years for four-year terms, and they bar from office holding actually both all other political parties. So the idea is to, you know, permanently expel the authoritarian right and also the anti-capitalist left. And this is one of the things that makes Colombia a darling, actually, of anti-communist reformers in the United States. It makes Colombia very sympathetic to anti-communist reform the U.S. government wants to promote. And it also makes Colombia very sympathetic to the World Bank as well. Another thing to know about Colombia is that Colombians had for a very long time, certainly since the early 20th century, conducted national politics and national political fights in part by looking for international advisors to come and take sides. So we know that there's a long history of international economic advising in Latin America, and sort of a very naive view of that is that, oh, advisors go and remake foreign societies and just stomp all over local people. Now, unquestionably, there is a relationship of power, but what exactly is the power that is exercised by foreign advisors? In Colombia, what you find all throughout the 20th century is that when there's a struggle going on within domestic politics, one of the basic maneuvers that you can make if you want to win over your opponents is to get an international advisor to come and issue the recommendation that is your recommendation. And that can help to tip the balance of power in conflicts. So the Colombian government from the 40s on is constantly inviting international advisors in, and different groups of Colombians who are not actually in the government do the same thing. And it's because it's one of the ways that they fight politics at home. So the Colombia becomes the first site, actually, or the site of the World Bank's first comprehensive country survey, which is published in 1950, becomes like a model for how you do country surveys all around the world. Colombia is a leading per capita recipient of World Bank loans, actually, in the whole world from 1950 to the mid 1970s. It's a showcase of the Alliance for Progress. They really invite foreign aid and foreign advising in because it's one of the ways that they do politics. That's not unique in Latin America or anywhere else in the world, but it is one of the reasons that Colombia is such an incredible crossroads. The other thing to know is that, you know, the story extends into moments of extraordinary crisis from the 1970s on. The whole world is going through a variety of crises here. And in Colombia, the kind of generalized world crisis, the political economic crisis of those decades, intersect with, first of all, the end of the National Front in the mid-1970s. By the 1980s, Colombia becomes, for the first time, actually a center of narcotics trading. That you get cocaine trafficking in Colombia. And you get just extraordinary political violence, which was a constant, a changing phenomenon, but a constant throughout this period, becomes extremely intense when cocaine becomes part of the picture. And by the mid-1980s and into the 1990s, it so profoundly destabilizes the state that by 1991, there's a new constitution and a complete restructuring of the state. So that's kind of some of the long narrative of Colombian politics. The only other thing I'll say about kind of background about Colombia is that the master narrative about Colombian politics in this period is that, first of all, Colombia had a very long-standing constitution from 1886 that lasted until 1991. And Colombia is often considered a highly centralized state during those years because the Constitution of 1886 provided for a politically centralized state. And one of the arguments that I make in the book is that actually there were also within that moment traditions of state decentralization that become important to understanding how the state grows.
Awesome. Yeah, thank you for that. This is really helpful, I think, for sort of situating the book and the arguments that you make. As we dive into some of the core arguments, I guess one place we thought we might start is with the title itself. So the book is called Sorting Out the Mixed Economy, The Rise and Fall of Welfare and Developmental States in the Americas. And I think to start out, we'd just love to take each of those phrases in turn quickly and try to, you know, ask you exactly what you were indicating with them. So I guess to start, you know, when you use the term the mixed economy, we'd love to hear you talk a little bit about what you're using that to mean, what it has otherwise been used to mean, and sort of where it comes from and how long it's been around.
When I was starting work on this book, one of the things that I realized is that there were very distinctive national vocabularies to talk about political economy in the United States and in Colombia, and that a lot of the words that run through 20th century U.S. history are really inapplicable if you're trying to write a transnational story, because they either mean something completely different outside of the United States, or they're just not even keywords. So one of the things I found was that the concept of the mixed economy was actually used in both the United States and Colombia to describe capitalist orders. And I found it to be something that showed me a lot, actually, about the time period. And I found it really, really helpful to think with. The mixed economy was an ideal of the mid-20th century. And it was used by people in capitalist economies in the first world and in the third world to describe capitalist orders. And what the mixed economy was, it was this imagined path between two highly stylized ideals. On the one hand, the stylized ideal of socialism and the ideal of laissez-faire, or to put it in different terms, the idea of complete state ownership and pure private competition. And the idea for, you know, people who are trying to construct capitalist orders in the mid-20th century is that you're trying to walk a path between those two ideals. You actually don't want socialism, right? Everybody in my book is anti-capitalist, pretty much, except for there are some dissenting movements. But everybody who's in a position of power is anti-capitalist. They do not want socialism, which they imagine is complete state ownership. And neither do they want
laissez-faire. Anti-communist, is that what you meant?
Yeah, they're anti-communist. What did I say?
I heard anti-capitalist, and it was...
There are some anti-capitalist figures in the book, but right, for the most part, everybody's anti-communist. Thank you for that correction. And so they're trying to imagine this space in between. The reason why the poles of laissez-faire and socialism are meaningful to them, of course, is because of the historical moment they're living in. This is the, you know, after the Great Depression. And so laissez-faire is, you know, a myth, right? But it's how they think of the order, you know, the liberal order before the Great Depression. And so they're trying not to return to that, to construct something that will be different from that. And meanwhile, of course, they're living in a world of socialist revolution, which is happening all around them. That's a real living possibility. And so the way that they think about and talk about capitalism is as kind of a space in between these two possibilities. And what they mean by a mixed economy then is it turns out to be a great variety of experiments that characteristically fuse public and private, for-profit and nonprofit, state and capital, state and society in innumerable ways. Because it turns out there's just a lot of possibility actually between pure private competition and complete state ownership. And the mixed economy in that sense becomes kind of an authorizing concept that, you know, under its banner, flourishes just this enormous variety of like real living practices that can involve states growing by developing new forms of for-profit contracting to large industrial corporations. It can involve states growing by delegating power to all sorts of regional and private intermediaries, from community action organizations to sort of new forms of public enterprise. It can involve the creation of public universities that are so intertwined with private capital that people can't even see them as public anymore. It can involve the growth of new private universities that usurp public functions. The mixed economy is predicated, the notion of the mixed economy is predicated on the idea that there is this like bright line between public and private, but the political ideal is actually to sort of systematically fuse them all the time. And so what I find is that actually in this moment, when the mixed economy is an ideal, it's an animating, you know, authorizing concept, the forms of statecraft that you get in the construction of Colombia's developmental state and the US welfare state can include practices that we don't remember anymore, actually, as welfarist and developmentalist, practices that today we would think of as purely neoliberal. And so I'm interested in looking at a number of practices that actually once thrived as developmentalist and welfarist practices that actually were critical to the expansion of state functions, and that actually proved to be kind of flexible enough and were championed by so many different groups that they could be redeployed and politically resignified after the 1970s to become symbols of neoliberalism. And so when I think about those decades of the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, I think that what happens is the sort of elements of the mixed economy become sorted from one another. So for instance, different forms of housing policy get, they meet different fates, right? In the United States, conventional public housing is destroyed in the United States. And meanwhile, I show that its historical twin, a policy that grew up alongside it, a very austere homeownership program called self-help housing, which grows up exactly alongside it. They're completely intertwined with one another. Self-help housing survives the rupture of the 1970s, and it becomes championed actually by ardent defenders of neoliberalism who identify themselves as such. And so on the one hand, there's this sort of sorting of actual practices. Some of them are destroyed or imperiled and targeted as these purportedly antiquated symbols of an overweening mid-century state, and others are kind of heralded as actually purportedly novel features of a new world in birth. And the other aspect of sorting out the mixed economy is this ideological aspect, where not only do practices get separated from each other, some of them being destroyed, some of them being repurposed, but also they become politically resignified, and there's processes of memory construction that actually kind of obscure actually their coexistence in the mid-century moment. So practices that get redeployed as neoliberal instruments in memory get evacuated from the past. And so there's a kind of a new version of history, actually, and a new account, a thinned out account of what the mid-century order was that erases a lot of the contradictions, injustices, and limitations, actually, of the strategy of capitalist development in the mid-20th century Americas.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is one of the, you know, the really fascinating things is just showing that policies that we think of as being classic neoliberal introduced, you know, in the 1970s, maybe, and or in the or after that, actually were developed earlier and were not seen as, you know, as opposed to the things that we think of or people think of as having preceded them. The one other aspect of this mid-century moment, I guess, that I wanted you to, or would love to have you elaborate a little bit on is, you know, these ideas of welfare state and developmental state. So, you know, in the United States, you describe the development, the creation of a welfare state, or that being sort of the goal. And in, whereas in Colombia, it was more of a developmental state. And it seems like these are based on somewhat different ideas of poverty, or at least what type of poverty is problematic for those particular countries. So, you know, the problem of poverty in the US in this moment, it seems like was quite different or was thought of differently as it was in Colombia and perhaps other Latin American countries. Could you describe a little bit what was going on there?
In the wake of the Great Depression, states all over the world take as their animating, legitimating function the resolution of problems of poverty. But poverty is conceptualized in very different ways in different parts of the world. We know actually from a really great and long tradition of writing on US history that by the 1950s in the United States, in the 1930s, maybe I'll start there. In both the US and in Latin America, the crisis of capitalism of the 1930s focused attention on the problem of the poverty of the nation. It was evident that there was something structurally wrong with these economies. And there was this tremendous search for new patterns of economic activity, new forms of regulation, new forms, basically new ways of producing and allocating value. And so macroeconomic issues become really a central concern in both of these regions. What happens in the wake of World War II is that, first of all, all of the Americas are rejuvenated by World War II. They are, they are very different from Europe. They are not destroyed, but they are given new life through the economic mobilization of World War II. And very different lessons come out of that experience. In Latin America, that idea that what the state can do is attempt to sort of fundamentally remake the structure of the national economy in order to change your position in the world becomes kind of affirmed by the experience of World War II. And so development, Latin Americans come to think of their states as developmental states, meaning states whose mission really is to transform a poor nation into a prosperous one, with poverty being measured in macroeconomic terms. This is, of course, the period of world history when governments all over the world are beginning to assemble macroeconomic statistics, national income accounts that allow you to measure the wealth and poverty of nations across the world. And Latin American developmentalism, like developmentalisms elsewhere, is fundamentally concerned with developing new sectors of the economy, often with industrializing, changing your position in world trade in order to sort of accomplish a wholesale transformation of the national economic order. And the understanding is that poverty that exists within your nation will be sort of addressed in part through the achievement, actually, of a new economic system, and that there may still be a need for different kinds of social policy as well, but that's kind of a subset, I guess, or a subsidiary practice of a state whose primary purpose is to transform the national economy. And in the United States, most New Dealers by the 1950s have come out of the Second World War taking a really different lesson from the kind of growth that occurs in that period, where they begin to actually resuscitate older ideas that the problem of poverty is really the problem of poor people. They come to say that there's really nothing wrong with the U.S. economy. U.S. economic growth, as the Sun Belt and the growth of suburbs become these incredible engines of growth in the United States, they're just unable to recognize the way in which the structure of the U.S. economy produces poverty internally, actually. And so what they say is that we're not an underdeveloped country. There is the problem of poverty isn't a national macroeconomic problem, but instead there are supposedly just isolated pockets of poverty in an otherwise prosperous and healthy capitalist order. And so knowledge about poverty in the United States isn't so much macroeconomic knowledge by the 1950s, but instead it's political science, it's sociology, it's psychology, it's anthropology. It's those fields that are supposed to study poor people and study poor communities and figure out how to transform them. So poverty comes to be conceptualized very differently. There's sort of the problem of poor people in the United States, or the idea of pockets of poverty in the United States, poverty as sort of an aberrant feature of a growing capitalist economy. And in Latin America, there's the idea that poverty is actually fundamentally a macroeconomic problem. This makes it actually really interesting then to study how ideas and practices might circulate between two societies that are actually addressing themselves to completely different problems. Most literature that we have, most historical literature that places US policymaking and intellectual life into a transnational frame, looks at what I, in the end of the book, call direct connections, meaning we see people who are working on a problem that they both define in the same way, exchanging ideas with one another. So we see agrarian reformers exchanging ideas. We see urban reformers exchanging ideas, people working on housing exchanging ideas, and so on. There's a lot that literature has taught us, but one of the things I became convinced of is that because in the case of poverty, the problem itself was conceptualized so differently, you have to start to look for connections that I think are actually far more pervasive, but often very indirect. circuitous connections, subtle connections between societies. So you find people, for instance, who are working on like massive river valley development projects in Latin America, who end up working on the privatization of training and education in the United States, because what the US welfare state is concerned with are questions like that, education and training, not, you know, the creation of a new macroeconomic plan or even a new regional plan for the United States. So the conceptualization of poverty in different ways is important to recognize, because it shapes the way that you, the way that ideas and practices move, which doesn't tend to be like between identical areas of policymaking in two countries, but instead what you see are just incredibly interesting forms of translation and adaptation of lessons from one realm of life to a completely different realm. Domains that you wouldn't think have anything to do with each other, it turns out, are really linked.
Yeah, one of the main characters in the book, in fact, the first character in the book that you start off with, David Lilienthal, seems to sort of epitomize this sense that, like, quote unquote, same practices and ideas, when they change context, just totally change the political, social, cultural valence of what it means.
Lilienthal is a really interesting figure who is sort of a narrative device in the book. This is a book that moves across so many different kind of contexts and projects that I thought it was helpful to have some kind of people who illuminate, I guess, sort of long-term connections. Lilienthal is a propagandist, very, very prolific. And for that reason, he makes a good narrative device, because he's constantly articulating the ideas of actually everybody around him. And he exemplifies certain transformations that are taking place. Lilienthal, to me, exemplifies one way of kind of drawing lessons out of the New Deal that I find in the book, that produces prescriptions by the 1970s that would seem to be pure inversions, actually, of the spirit of the New Deal, but which I argue are not. And so Lilienthal, first of all, from the time that he's a New Dealer all through the end of his life, champions the notion of state decentralization. And one of the arguments that I make in the book is that state decentralization has a really long, that concept is not kind of an invention. In Latin America, people think of state decentralization as a new prescription of the 80s and 90s. And I argue that not just in Latin America, but also in the United States, this was actually a key term in politics that was used to understand many different forms of statecraft. And so Lilienthal, actually in the 1940s, is arguing that the lesson of the Tennessee Valley Authority is the value of state decentralization, because this is a, you know, we remember the TVA as an expression of the growth of the federal power. It's a you know, national agency. And he argues, though, that because it operates autonomously, that it represents state decentralization. And he also is arguing, really from the 1940s on, not only that kind of this form of sort of decentralized public administration within the state is valuable, but also that the New Deal's lesson isn't that like government action independently and in and of itself is a solution to anything, but that what the New Deal was about was properly combining public and private initiative in ways that would serve the public good. And these are longstanding features of his thought. If you think back, I mean, even before he was a New Dealer, he was a public utility regulator. And the spirit of regulation is not anti-capitalist in any way, right? I mean, there can be many different ideas that go into public regulation, but it's just a mistake to think that New Dealers like started out as, you know, like hostile to capitalism. There were many features of the New Deal. And Lilienthal is somebody who basically has ideas about state decentralization about kind of the need to properly combine public and private initiatives, state and capital, in ways that will serve the public good. And he adapts those ideas all throughout his life to produce changing prescriptions, absolutely, as he becomes embedded in different contexts. So in the 1950s, he decides he wants to become a businessman, and he sees the corporation and the state as structural analogs. He's not unusual in this. Neoclassical economists all through the 20th century regarded the state and the firm actually as structural analogs and thought you could reason about them using the same tools. And Lilienthal basically takes his ideas about state decentralization and he uses them to explain why decentralization of firms is also actually for the good politically, economically and morally as well, and makes common cause with people who we think of as, you know, basically the right. You know, he's celebrating GE in the 1950s, which we know had a very, very aggressive program of kind of right-wing political indoctrination among employees and in the wider public. What they share is this belief actually in decentralization, which could be rationalized from the perspective of GE through sort of Cold War denigration of central planning and of socialism as a symbol of centralism, and which Lilienthal says also finds legitimation in the history of the New Deal. And when Lilienthal becomes, in the 1950s, not just a businessman, but he decides to become an international economic advisor, he finds his first job in Colombia, where basically he's invited to Colombia. The only reason he works there, he doesn't know anything about Colombia, but he's invited there by a group of capitalists in the city of Cali who are doing what Colombians have always done. They're trying to win a fight in national politics by inviting a foreign advisor to issue their chosen prescription. And these are a group of capitalists who are really interested in raising regional productivity and developing agribusiness and urban industry in the what's called the Cauca Valley. It's a very rich, both in terms of resources and in terms of money, rich agricultural region of Latin America. And Cali is one of Colombia's four major cities. And these capitalists are the heads, the regional heads of the most powerful business association in Colombia. And what they want to do is get the national government to charter a river valley development agency that they will run in order to reorganize the landscape and economy of this region. And they invite Lilienthal to come and issue that recommendation. And they say, you know, basically they see that like his ideas about the TVA are completely convenient to them. And so he develops this very long-term relationship with them. The creation of this new regional development corporation in Colombia is explicitly defended as a model of state decentralization. So here again, people think back to this period and they think, oh, the Colombian state is, you know, is growing and this is the expansion of national power. Here they create this new public enterprise, this new River Valley Development Agency. But the people who actually are behind it, both the foreign advisors like Lilienthal and the local capitalists, they conceptualize it actually as a model of state decentralization, because what they do is they get the national state to devolve power that had previously been reserved for the national government itself. They devolve it to this board of local businessmen. So one of the things that this symbolizes is decentralization as regional devolution, and indeed the invention of the River Valley, of the natural region as a new jurisdiction in Colombian governance. The other thing that's sort of implied by this notion of decentralization is a blurring of the line between public and private authority, as these, you know, businessmen who are the leading capitalists in the area and the heads already of a business association in the area have state powers vested in them. And the line between, you know, this public enterprise and the private interest, the, you know, capitalist class interest, becomes incredibly blurry in the activities of the CVC. So that's one way where we start to get the concept of state decentralization sort of being mobilized and applied in a new way. And over time, Lilienthal continues to just, you know, he's an evangelist for this idea, and he finds new groups of capitalists constantly, essentially, to embed himself in. In the 1960s, he returns to the U.S. public eye as U.S. capitalists are recoiling from, you know, incredible public rebuke. They are under attack, and they know it in the United States because of social movements that are showing that U.S. capital is a source of racial inequality, of economic exploitation, of war. One of the strategies that capitalists develop in the 1960s to defend themselves is to argue that actually the corporation can be a solution to the very problems that social movements have put on the national agenda. And you get particularly veterans of foreign policy who have spent the last decade and more working in third world development programs, arguing, you know, on the basis of that experience, that capital can serve the public interest, and you get them promoting new forms of actually privatization of state functions, for-profit privatization of U.S. welfare state functions. And this is where Lilienthal, once again, he's just a propagandist. He's not the moving part in this story, but he's a propagandist who says, yeah, this is the embodiment of that old idea of decentralization I've been championing all along. When the U.S. welfare state starts to, when the federal government under the Johnson administration starts to sign for-profit contracts with industrial corporations to run federal training and education programs under the war on poverty. He says this is the embodiment of this idea of decentralization of state functions that I've always championed. So in Lilienthal's life, I don't think that there's like a moment when he sells out. He's just somebody who, he wasn't left wing ever. You know what I mean? He has an idea that that could be applied in principle in many different ways. But from the 1950s on, he's drawing out lessons from the New Deal that consistently rationalize the devolution of power to capitalists, sometimes through the form of public enterprise and sometimes through the privatization of public functions.
It seems like the justification of his management science moves from a kind of valorization of democracy under the TVA to productivity when he's in Colombia to this kind of like social mediation function when he returns to the Great Society.
Well, when Lilienthal was in the 1940s writing about the TVA and into the 1950s, he talked about it as a model of grassroots democracy, right? Now that, you know, by the late 1940s was already questioned within the United States. You think of, you know, Philip Selznick and other critics of the TVA who argued that the TVA's commitment to master planning and also to sort of the mastery of resources really put it at odds with genuine democratic decision making. The TVA bowled over local people whose, you know, properties were flooded for and tenant farmers as well, whose lands were flooded by dams. It came into, you know, tremendous conflict, even as it did, of course, extend electrification and services to you know, an extremely poor region that private utilities have never been interested in working in. But the sort of authenticity of its claims to be sort of a model of grassroots democracy had already really come under attack in the United States by the time he goes to Colombia. And what's interesting is that, again, Lilienthal is not the mover in this story. Lilienthal goes to Colombia, and because the capitalists there are in the driver's seat, the leaders of this business association, Andi, in Cali, are in the driver's seat. And these are people who nobody could ever believe that, like, they represented, you know, grassroots democracy. These are, obviously elites who actually have great desires to, they have highly exploitative relationships with rural and urban workers as well in this region. And so they just don't talk about decentralization through the concept of grassroots democracy. And instead, they come up with a whole different set of rationalizations and arguments for why decentralization is the best way for a state to work. They argue that it, first of all, is more effective, that Bogota is too far away and too little informed to actually come up with effective integrated regional plans, and that by delegating power to local elites who are deeply informed and deeply embedded and who can act on behalf of their society, that that's how a state can be most effective. And their image of society is one in which basically a region like a river valley, they argue that natural formation gives rise actually to a homogeneous society, one in which everyone encounters the same problems of, you know, flooding, salinity in the soil, difficulties with production. But that's a shared problem that affects everybody. And therefore, regionally situated technical experts can speak for the whole society. So this is a theory that affirms their own power in social conflicts locally. And that becomes their argument for this. When you get back to the United States, again, Lilienthal embeds himself with capitalists who are in, particularly in the Committee for Economic Development, but there's many groups of capitalists who are involved in trying to insinuate themselves into the US welfare state. And there they make arguments that management, that the sort of, that the systems that corporations have for organizing production are generic systems that can be used to organize any complex process. And so they posit that the firm is actually just a model for the state, that the problems of, you know, public administration and public functions are just species of business administration, actually. And that in that sense, businessmen are statesmen who, like, within the firm are showing their capacities to govern, actually, in public life. It's a deeply anti-democratic vision of government as management. And so it's true, you're right, that, you know, by this time, the whole idea of like grassroots democracy that had once been Lilienthal's kind of vernacular in the 1940s has gone away. The kind of rationalization is different. It's a more brazenly anti-democratic vernacular, although they would not admit it as such.
The other evolution, it seems to me, and it points to your earlier sort of mentioning of the seeming paradox between the level of decentralization that happens in, for example, the Cauca Valley and the sort of more mainstream appreciation of this 50s moment as a moment of the strengthening of the state, at least in Latin American countries, is that for the Cauca Valley capitalists, decentralization or the creation of this autonomous regional agency, it seems like a way for developmental statecraft, in a word, right? That they are in fact strengthening the state through this regional agency. Whereas in the 70s, when Lilienthal gets back to the US, it seems like that context has completely shifted, where it's less about state building or statecraft and more about, you know, how can we make efficient the sort of bureaucratic overgrowth of the American state or something like that. It feels like the weak state in Colombia versus the sort of, at least perceived by the capitalist class embodied in Lilienthal, the sort of overgrowth of the U.S. state seems to really condition a lot of the ideas and the sort of internal justifications of the ruling class in both contexts. I don't know if you think that might be a way to reconcile, I guess, the decentralization with state building in the Latin American case or not.
In both contexts, decentralization is a tool to build state functions, but it's so riddled with contradictions that it can portend many different futures. So in Colombia, the creation, we're sort of maybe beating this example to death, but I'm happy to talk about it. The creation of the CDC, this regional development corporation, this is a public enterprise that's chartered by the national state, and it undertakes a vast program of flood control, damming, irrigation, scientific research, that extends, whose purpose is fundamentally, right, this is a bunch of public activities that whose fundamental purpose, though, is to support capitalist enterprise, right, by sort of clearing the way for new agribusiness development to produce an agricultural surplus that then can be invested in urban industrialization and so on. And so this is my sort of point about the mixed economy. There's no separation of public and private, right? But that's not to say that this is a form of retrenchment. This is the state taking on new functions, and the means by which they do it is the same means by which they also enrich and empower capitalists who might then go on to do many other things that can have political consequences. And in the United States, when we look at training and education, maybe I'll explain a little more what I've been referring to here. We know that in the war on poverty, the federal government was not primarily interested in economic redistribution. The kind of animating idea behind the war on poverty was generally that the US had a well-functioning, growing economy, and that there were some people who hadn't been able to avail themselves of the opportunities within it. And so in lieu of redistribution, there were going to be programs that would, for instance, train people. There were, you know, big focus on manpower training. And the idea of, you know, having programs like Job Corps, and I look at other programs, for instance, that were run by the Bureau of Indian Affairs on Indian reservations, as well as there's a program called Jobs. There's a whole series of training programs. And the idea was to sort of take what were at the time called the hardcore unemployed or juvenile delinquents and prepare them to go and compete in the labor market. And these programs are unquestionably expanding the responsibilities and reach of the state. Important to recognize is that the mechanism by which they're carried out is different from the mechanism that the New Deal state had used in, say, the Civilian Conservation Corps. So where that had been run directly by the federal government, veterans of U.S. foreign and imperial affairs, people who were involved in as foreign investors in Latin America, people who were involved in foreign development and aid projects overseas, people who were involved in military contracting. So U.S. businessmen who had those kinds of experiences, as well as those who'd been involved in Indian industrialization policies on U.S. Indian reservations. They come and tell the Johnson administration the best way to run your training and education programs is going to be by contracting them for profit with private capital, that we are actually the instruments that are best positioned to carry out this state function. So this is public money. It's an expansion in federal spending, and it's an expansion in the services that Americans can expect to get from the state. There's no question that it's an expansion of the welfare state, but you're right that it's a very peculiar way to do it, because what it does simultaneously is validate the claims that for-profit corporations have that, first of all, they are the guarantors of public welfare, that they are legitimate recipients of tax revenues, actually, that their role in the provision of social welfare is not to pay taxes, but actually to receive taxes as contractors. And they established themselves, you know, as authorities on subjects like education. And by the late 1960s, you have U.S. you know, industrial corporations creating subsidiaries because of the enticements of federal spending and local spending that are actually getting contracts with local school districts in the United States to go and teach public school children for profit. This is the absolutely the origins of something that we think of today as purely a kind of an instrument of reaction, right? Purely something that was just trying to take apart the state. But what's important to realize is the parasitic relationship that capital had to the state, that it only was able to grow. And this is a long, this is just a, this is a feature of capitalism always and everywhere, that capital grows through its engagement with the state. And in this particular moment, what's interesting is that the welfare state actually was really being eyed by capital because it was a growth area. And for capitalists who had long, you know, lived and died by military contracts, by foreign aid contracts, and so on, they just look around the state and they look where it's where the spending is growing and they insinuate themselves into it. So the growth of the state is not separate from the growth of capital. It actually is one of the driving forces that allows capital to, I mean, to pursue accumulation. And it also then shapes the corporation itself. The reason that corporations end up in some of these areas is because the state was going there. The reason that you get for-profit educational contractors, the reason that you get for-profit testing and assessing and assessment companies isn't because the state was receding or they were trying to beat back the state. It's that they grew through the subsidization and activation that the state provided.
Yeah, I think that's really incredible and such a helpful way of looking at this, what we think of as privatization or delegation to private entities from a new perspective. One thing I guess I wondered about was to what extent do you see, I mean, so one sort of, I think, story that I took from the book is that this sort of circulation of ideas, I guess, between the United States and Latin America, Colombia specifically in this case, and that, you know, that the, you were just describing how, you know, people who had been in working in third world development or working on Indian reservations came back to the as a great society and sort of said, you know, the way to do this is to contract through private entities. On the other hand, it seems like there's also going on this story that you were just articulating of, you know, corporation capitalists in the United States saying, like, how are we going to, you know, where do we grow next? Like, which parts of the states are expanding? Oh, it's the welfare state. Let's go there. And so I guess I'm kind of curious, do you see this as like, is the role of the people who are going back and forth between the US and the developing world it, one of sort of legitimation of what the US capitalists were doing, or were they actually sort of bringing new ideas, you know, like totally novel ideas to the US government or maybe even directly to the capitalists saying like, this is how you should go forward?
This is a really important question. It's you know, a question that you know Latin Americanists might ask, right? Is what kind of power do foreign advisors, lenders, you know, do basically foreigners have? Is it that they introduce fundamentally unknown ideas and kind of destroy essentially like local forms of knowledge or policy traditions and so on? And likewise, the same question can be asked in the United States. Does foreign experience basically result in like the kind of domestication or repatriation of like unknown practices. And what I try to argue in the book is that that's too simple an image. That first of all, in Latin America, I mean, I've already sort of indicated this previously, that one of the things that foreign advising does is shift the balance of power in domestic disputes of longstanding. So by providing funding, for instance, to a particular group, or by providing, a recommendation, what can often happen is actually that, you know, the advisors are not introducing new ideas, but they are helping to authorize or to directly fund and enable an idea that may not have won out otherwise. And so they produce kind of the presence of foreign influence produces a new terrain for struggle within Latin American societies. And in the United States, likewise, these processes of mediation are important to think about. So one example of this, for instance, is another sort of policy area I look at, which is housing. In the United States during the Great Society, during the War on Poverty, you get this really new federal backing for a policy called self-help housing, which is basically a very austere form of social welfare provision where the state provides some combination of the following. They might provide land and mortgage loans and plans and supervision. And then people go out and build their own houses. And this is a policy that was used all over the world, actually, in the mid-20th century as a developmentalist prescription. And it becomes used actually as a rural housing program in the United States to farm, to house farm workers and Indians living on reservations. And it's not a policy that had no history in the United States, but it's a policy that had had very limited sanction and mostly actually hostility from the federal government until the 1960s. Within the frame of US history, self-help housing had begun as an imperial policy that was actually used in the New Deal during the 1930s and 1940s. And it's a really fascinating picture of just how sort of multivalent the New Deal is and how many futures it portended. So US public housing law, which on the mainland was used to where local housing authorities would they used it to create publicly built, publicly owned rental housing, apartment buildings. Public housing law was applied and interpreted very differently by Puerto Rican officials. And what they used it for was to create self-help housing, actually to turn the poor into homeowners through unpaid labor. And US veterans of those Puerto Rican programs came out as real champions of them. They thought that this was the model for the third world. And they become involved then in shaping US foreign policy in Colombia and in many, many other parts of the world to promote self-help housing. In the third world, in the 1950s and 1960s, self-help housing becomes a mass housing program. I mentioned that look at the construction of the largest housing project built in Latin America under the Alliance of Progress. It was a self-help housing program in the capital city, Bogota, Colombia. It's designed to house 84,000 people. It's called Ciudad Kennedy. Today, it's actually the largest of the localities in the city. It would be like the size of a city by itself. So this is absolutely huge mass housing, and the U.S. government is deeply involved as a foreign aid, a source of foreign aid to self-help housing in the third world. Now, while all that is going on, back on the U.S. mainland, there actually are experiments and there are attempts to develop self-help housing by all sorts of dissident groups on the U.S. mainland, actually, that are struggling with the fact that there's a lot of people who are really shut out of federal mortgage programs. And who come to it with all sorts of political ideas. Many of these, they're Quakers, they're pacifists. Some of them are civil rights activists. Some of them are sort of Jeffersonian anti-modernists. There's all sorts of politics, as many kind of rural political traditions as there are in the United States. There are visions of self-help housing. And they just cannot catch a break. It is so hard for them to get any federal funding. The federal government does not want this on the US mainland for the most part. There are just very limited exceptions to it. And it's just this funny thing that happens, right? Or it seems funny, right? That when the war on poverty begins, suddenly these groups that have been just struggling and struggling for years to try and do self-help housing, where it's basically just been a private initiative, not, you know, build your own home programs were private initiatives, but they weren't public policy. Suddenly they start getting funding from the war on poverty. And it's because these officials in Washington, the people in the Office of Economic Opportunity who are, you know, working under Sergeant Shriver, they, you know, they include people who have been working in community development overseas previously. They are familiar with these kinds of programs, and they start to authorize on the U.S. mainland a practice that wasn't unknown or unconceptualized or unheard of, but that just never got federal sanction before. And so meanwhile, so first of all, this is an example of how kind of foreign experience can change the possibilities that exist at home. And it also, then if you follow these architects, for instance, who come from the United States, they had worked in Latin America and in other parts of the third world on self-help housing programs. The fact that the federal government starts to fund and approve self-help housing projects for Native people and for farm workers in the United States gives them new paths where they can move in. They come back to the United States, they work on all sorts of projects in the US. And by the late 1960s, US housing policy looks more like third world housing policy in a lot of ways, right? There's just the ability to move in many directions. So you find people who, some of their careers, you know, they're like Quakers who've worked entirely in the United States, and by the late 1960s, they're going to Zambia. And in other cases, it's people who basically work in Latin America first, then they are back trying to adapt their ideas, you know, in Detroit and on Indian reservations and so on and so forth. So the answer to your question is no. Foreign advisors do not introduce in general ideas that are wholly unknown in another place. But the way that societies interact can transform the terms of domestic conflict. They can transform the possibilities that open and close, actually, for people who have been struggling with each other for a long time.
Yeah, self-help housing is such a compelling case study in your book. And it goes to show exactly, you know, the degree of complexity that the transmission of ideas, this process that did take in the sort of linked histories of the US and Colombia. But I wanted to briefly turn to maybe another case study in your book, which is the rise of management science. First in Colombia, because I feel like, you know, the standard narrative of neoliberalism, we associate corporate managers with the fully mature sort of multi-divisional firm or corporation or something in the US. But I think the rise of management that you draw out Unibail, the university in the Cauca Valley, it takes on a very different, it's much more about, as you were saying earlier, domestic battles and fights over policy and bidding for funds, both public and private. So I was wondering if you could give a sense of how the managerial revolution occurred in Colombia.
If you read about the history of, first of all, of kind of the rise of neoliberalism in Latin America, there are outstanding books that actually focus on the history of economic thought and that focus on the formation of new university programs in Latin America across the second half of the 20th century. And the master narrative that you'll find, and these are books that influenced me that are excellent, that I recommend to every reader. Some of the great examples of this literature are the book Pinochet's Economist by Juan Gabriel Valdés, or Sarah Babb's book, Managing Mexico. And these were books that focus on the transformation of national economics professions in Chile in one case, in Mexico in the other case. And the story that they tell is one of basically an economics profession and particular universities that from the 1930s into the 1960s supported and were sort of really led by particular schools of thought, structuralists, Marxists, a variety of schools of thought. And the way in which beginning at some point in the post-war period, the exact date differs from book to book, contact with particular schools of thought in the United States transplants neoclassical theory to Latin America. Often that's associated with the rise of rival universities, actually, where the economics programs in those universities, which are highly linked to, for instance, the Chicago School in the United States or other kind of US universities, neoclassical, you know, economic theory is ascendant in the United States in general in this period. Likewise, you know, these Latin American, new Latin American programs are linked to international financial institutions. And the rise of neoliberalism is sort of linked to and maybe a direct product of the ascent of this new school of economic thought and these new universities that incubate them, that have very different politics and very different international relationships. So when I went to do research on Columbia, I was very interested in the making of new economics programs in Columbian universities, and I expected to find some version of this story. And it became evident to me very quickly that that was not a story to be found actually in Columbia. I ended up looking at the sort of process of sort of the formation of new professions and new knowledge in Columbia in a somewhat different way. The rise and fall of kind of rival schools of thought is a story. It's a very, very important story, but it's just not the only process that's taking place. So if you look in Columbia, for instance, the school that is known preeminently as the neoliberal university in Columbia, the school that produced the economists who were responsible for the Colombian's economic opening, as it's called, of the early 1990s, they come out of the Universidad de los Andes in Bogota, which is a private university. And if you look at the economics department at that school, it would be considered intolerably heterodox in the United States. It never became just a bastion of neoclassical theory. It was never closely tied to any of the kind of like usual suspects in kind of in the North Atlantic in quite the way that, you know, these other books would lead me to imagine. And so just looking at that, I had to ask, you know, how did neoliberal prescriptions emerge from such a heterodox intellectual environment? And the next thing I noticed was that when I went into the archives of, I looked at sort of the two economics programs in Colombia that got the lion's share of international aid. One was Los Andes, which is in Bogota, and the other is the Universidad del Valle in the city of Cali, the same place where the Cauca Valley Corporation, this regional development corporation, gets created. And when I looked inside their the papers, the archives of those universities, and when I looked also in the archives of the Rockefeller Foundation, which was providing them with an enormous amount of aid, it's just not debates between, you know, structuralists and neoclassicals. That is not what's going on in there. Instead, what's going on in the formation of new economics professions is something much more fundamental. What's going on after the Second World War is that Colombia is trying to conjure a new economics profession where actually none had existed quite in this form before. There have been people called economists in Colombia since the 19th century, but they were not credentialed as economists. They had law degrees and they had engineering degrees. And what made them an economist was the kind of work that they did. They made national economic policy, they ran business enterprises. In some cases, they also taught courses actually at universities. And the courses that they taught were courses in political economy, which existed as a specialization within schools of law and administration. And in the wake of the Great Depression all around Latin America, governments are trying to create a new kind of economist who can impart a new kind of rationality to statecraft. And so this is the moment when you get the birth of new economics professions and freestanding economics departments. And the attempt to form a new discipline and profession meant that the preeminent debate that was going on in there is who qualifies as an economist, what qualifies as an economic question, what are the boundaries of this field, and what is its worldly jurisdiction? What kinds of problems are economists supposed to be in charge of? And essentially what's going on is it's very hard to say what the difference between an economist and a manager is, because previously businessmen had been called economists and they exercised enormous authority in precisely the areas of statecraft around, you know, economic policymaking that economists were trying to say was actually uniquely theirs. What comes of this is actually an attempt at self-definition by economists that says, look, what defines an economist is not a school of thought. It's not a particular methodological orientation. It's a public purpose. That what an economist is a state planner, a state policymaker. The economist is the person who is the dispassionate arbiter of social conflicts and the dispassionate guardian of the public good. And the reason for that, they say, is that economists have this concept of the economy, and they have a concept of economic growth. And through those, they get a bird's eye view of the entire society, all of its activities, supposedly. Of course, that's not true, but they say supposedly, right? That supposedly, they comprehend the entirety of society, the different ways that different sectors can engage with each other, and they, through the pursuit of economic growth, can meet the needs of all people. They can harmonize social interests. They can reconcile what seem to be contrary interests in society and produce a comprehensive economic plan that will serve the interests of all. That is the fundamental definition, actually, of economics that's emerging here. And it's not about a particular school of thought. It's actually about a conception of the public that identifies economists with the public interest. I've gone through all this. I'm sorry, it's a very long wind up to get to your question. This is the context in which I understand managers, because managers are essentially having their jobs usurped here. They are being defined by economists as being associated purely with the private. And in that sense, I see the growth, right? The idea is that what economists do is manage all the big public questions and speak for the public good. And what managers do is they are narrowly self-interested, you know, masters of the shop floor and the corner office. They have knowledge that is uniquely suited to the firm, right? And that's all they do. That's all they can be responsible for, because they are not interested in the public good. They are interested in the pursuit of profit, actually. And that's correct, they say, right? They think that's legitimate, but it's just different. They shouldn't be allowed to masquerade as, you know, publicly minded, disinterested guardians of the public good, and they can't make public policy. That's what's going on in the formation of these new disciplines and professions, more than any sort of internal debate. It's like an unaffordable luxury to be like arguing over like which particular like economic theory you prefer. Not that people don't argue about that, they do, but it's like a second order debate, where the first order of business is to expel the managers, get the businessmen out of there and stop them from calling themselves economists and expand the jurisdiction of people who you think are real economists. The result is this ferocious response from managers who, in this context, organize very self-consciously and avail themselves of the fact that there's a very blurry distinction between public and private in the state, in the university, and in the entire society that is a systematic product of the mixed economy. And so what they do is they organize themselves within the very same university reform programs in Columbia to create management programs that are like essentially part of the economics program, or in some cases they split off and they become separate MBA programs. And they use the university, the public university particularly, as proving grounds in which managers not only get trained, and the argument is that public universities can serve the public good by producing managers, right? That management is a form of like community leadership. But they also start to take on roles as administrators and overseeing the finances as well of public universities. And what they're interested in doing is demonstrating that managers are not actually suited to running private corporations, but that in fact they are proper stewards of the state, that in fact they can run public institutions in for the public good. And coming out of these attempts at university reform, you get managers trying to actually take the exact same position in public life that economists are claiming, saying that managers in fact have exactly the kind of knowledge that can rationalize the state, that management is a universal technique, that it's not specifically kind of oriented to the business corporation. But in fact, it's a general form of rationalization and mastery that can apply everywhere. And this is where you get these anti-democratic arguments that government is nothing but a species of management. Coming out of these programs, then indeed, you find businessmen who provide exactly those kinds of arguments for widening the purview of corporate management in the making of public policy and in the administration of government activities.
So when I think of like a successful developmental state, I think of something like Taiwan or South Korea. where the state has a significant amount of autonomy from society and from capitalists and are able to discipline capitalists. And so there's a kind of sense of rivalry between state elites and private elites. But it seems like one of the things that went wrong in the history that you're telling, or at least went very differently from maybe the East Asian example, is precisely the mixed economy wasn't able to generate these kinds of divisions between state elites and capitalist elites that would allow the state to discipline it, right? So you don't actually get the productivity and you don't actually get resolutions to social questions by managers or at very excellent training programs. What you get is private capital accumulation, upward redistribution of land, and privatized labor training functions, right? This is the contradiction of mixed economy, right? Is the failure to generate sufficient autonomy to actually discipline capital.
There's two different things for us to think about. One is whether we want to analyze the performance of these states on their own terms. On their own terms, they were very successful in a lot of ways. I mean, Colombia actually, the Cauca Valley Corporation is very, very successful actually in its own terms. Its flood control measures, irrigation, land reclamation, consolidation of capitalist agribusiness hugely increase the productivity of rural agriculture, facilitate the growth in urban the growth and industrialization of the city of Cali. Colombia in general in this period, you know, is like the very image in some ways of what international lenders and development theorists wanted for Latin America in the Cold War. It's an anti-communist government that bars communists from national politics. It maintains close ties to the United States and it meets growth goals. So it's not, I actually don't think that what we need to do is demonstrate that they failed on their own terms. I think that the critique in this book is more the other one that's contained in your comment, that actually, first of all, we can question whether their goals were our goals. I think that the pursuit of growth sustained many inequalities and injustices. And for sure, there are many ways to grow. So, I mean, first of all, there can be critiques of growth. And I think that's one way in which our time differs from theirs. One doesn't have to be a kind of a pure kind of degrowth thinker to recognize that there were many problems with the pursuit of growth. But even so, there are, of course, many ways to grow, as you note. And these were strategies that did systematically strengthen and enrich private capital. Now, I do want to insist, though, that there were rival visions in this moment. We've emphasized the parts of the book that focus on the infiltration of private capital, the kind of blurriness between state and capital. And that's a really important part of the story. But for instance, in housing programs, we see actually the kind of internationalism and the mobilizations of many other groups that are really, for instance, in the United States, kind of dissenters on the North American mainland. The people who are champions of self-help housing include people who are really social democrats, who are trying desperately to bring U.S. Housing funds to people who have really never had access to them before, who were completely shut out, really, of New Deal housing programs. Farm workers, native people living on reservations, and they see self-help housing, as diminutive as it is, as a little wedge to open up the welfare state. And they are indeed actually bringing new forms of state spending, and they're channeling it often through community groups that and sort of local organizations that are not just like vehicles of capital at all. And so we see multiple kind of visions here. Now, at the same time, self-help housing could also be and was celebrated by like foot soldiers of the New Right, who said, "Oh, well, this is a great alternative too. This is not like something to complement, say, public housing and other forms of sort of collective ownership as a foundation of shared economic security. This is an alternative to those things, and we will celebrate it and expand it as we try and destroy actually systems of public development and ownership." So there's one of the things I want to insist on is that there isn't a single political possibility in within the mixed economy. The mixed economy is rife with contradictions. That doesn't mean that all outcomes were equally likely. It doesn't mean that the sort of social democratic future was as likely to be realized as the neoliberal future. But I am trying to argue that we shouldn't just tell the history of the 20th century with an eye to sort of knowing that what we end up with is neoliberalism, because it tends to erase all of the contradictions, actually, of the mid-century period.
Right, that makes sense. Yeah, I mean, the mixed economy was sorted out. This is obviously a very big change over time story. But I do want to push back on this idea that Colombia was a, or maybe you can enlighten me a little bit more about how Colombia is a success story, because when I look at, I don't know, just basic GDP per capita numbers, it doesn't really seem like the growth paradigm took off there, right? Like, I think they did fail in their own terms, their own developmentalist growth terms. And it's precisely because of this second, more kind of like critical anti-capitalist reason.
Colombia became a middle-income country. Colombia was regarded by, you know, when you read economists' studies of Colombia, it was regarded as a pretty successful model, actually, in Latin America. And when economists discussed what they considered to be its failings, they said that, well, you know, the sort of persistence of political violence is a very significant problem. And, you know, in any country, there are sort of critiques of, you know, if you're a middle-income country, you're not a high-income country, right? But in this moment, you know, certainly by the 70s, Colombia is regarded as more or less a success story. Moreover, when you look into the debt crisis of the 1980s, Colombia never had the levels of indebtedness that, say, Mexico did. When Mexico defaults in 1982, the whole region gets cut off from funding, from international lending. The whole region suffers. But Colombia was actually considered to have, by international financial institutions and so on, to have had actually very moderate policies that were a model in the region. Now, what I might say is the following. You're thinking of East Asia and homogenizing perhaps Latin America a bit, that, you know, perhaps if we want to find alternatives to the story that I look at in Colombia and in the United States, that maybe we would look to East Asia. What's important to recognize is that Colombia and the United States are I think propitious for studying here, because they are anti-communist and counter-revolutionary states in this period. And if you look around Latin America, you find actually many other kinds of growth and many other kinds of economic experimentation all through this exact same period. And those are places that you can that can teach us a lot. So for instance, you know, one of the most common ways to think about Latin American history in the 20th century is that it's a site of numerous social revolutions. And in those experiments in social revolution, we find, for instance, ways of thinking about possibilities of redistribution, possibilities of growth, and a lot of actually important questions arise out of them. So for instance, if we're trying to think about, first of all, redistribution as an alternative to just the pursuit of growth. I mean, for sure, in Colombia and in the United States, downward redistribution is for the most part the idea that is that nobody in power wants to attempt. They're constantly looking for non-antagonistic ways to deal with problems of poverty without dispossessing those who have, you know, expropriated their way and, legislated their way into wealth and power. And, you know, so in that sense, for sure, you know, the instinct is to say, you know, like, right, redistribution is the great untried idea. And I firmly, firmly believe that. I think that's one of the lessons of this book. I mean, footnote there, there are examples of redistribution that do happen, you know, in these moments that we should remember. So, you know, when we think about the war on poverty, the most effective anti-poverty programs were Medicare, Medicaid, civil rights legislation. That's what made the difference, not job training programs. And so we shouldn't forget those. But the animating spirit of the time was for sure grow rather than redistribute. Now, how should we think about redistribution? Given that in US and Colombian history, we have very few examples in this book that would give us anything to think with, we can end up with a very simple view, I guess, of what redistribution looks like. And that's where looking at social revolution in Latin America can actually really help us think, because there are many examples actually of genuine redistributive reforms. So for instance, if we look at land reforms in Latin America, in other Latin American countries in revolutionary contexts, you find, you know, quite extraordinary redistribution of land. This is the case, for instance, in Guatemala after 1952 to 1954. It's the case in Chile under Allende during the Chilean road to socialism. These are both very brief periods of time, right? These are places where we see the beginnings of a policy, the beginnings of a transformation that are ended through violence. But they raise really interesting questions for us. First is that they cause us to, first of all, recognize that the pursuit of growth was everywhere. That growth can be sort of pursued in different ways. So for instance, if you look in Latin American agrarian reforms, and they all enshrine these two different principles. One is the pursuit of redistribution, and the other is actually the pursuit of raising productivity and contributing to national economic growth. That's embedded in all Latin American agrarian reforms, whether they're sponsored by, you know, socialist or communist authors, or whether they're produced by, you know, capitalist, you know, like in Colombia, the you know, counter-revolutionary agrarian reform has those two goals in them. And a lot of what matters is who implements them. So in Guatemala, the way that the agrarian reform was implemented was through a system of committees, basically, where peasant leagues would bring demands for land to a local committee where, you know, campesinos, local people were participants in that, and they would make an adjudication. It would go all the way up to the president. And that really affected the way that the law actually got implemented. It embodied an idea that the prerequisite for growth actually was to redistribute, that if you took, you know, unused or inadequately used land from large estates and you redistributed them in small private property to peasants or into co-ops, that land hungry people would put that land to use. And that's how that law was applied. Whereas in Colombia, a law that contained those two exact same principles to redistribution and to productivity gets implemented, as I show in the Cauca Valley, by capitalists who say, actually, redistribution would undermine productivity in this region because very, very small farmers can't use, you know, tractors and fertilizer and could never be as productive as you know, larger scale capitalist enterprise. And so when they implement the law, what they actually do with it is they displace very large numbers of really, really poor people, and they use the law actually to consolidate agribusiness in the area. So one important thing is to, when you're thinking about a redistribution program, is to sort of think about who's empowered to make decisions. This is a profound question in the United States, where by the 1930s already, when you look at the New Deal, when the federal government has large plans to implement, they're looking around and they're saying, you know, what kinds of institutions do we have in the United States that have administrative capacity, that have large scale scope, that could actually implement a large program? And because of the nature of US policymaking and US history in the 19th century, what they have are industrial corporations, business associations, and the military. It's a profound problem and an enduring one in US society, the difficulty of actually constructing the kinds of institutions that could, in a more egalitarian way, actually carry out some kind of redistributive policy or even a growth policy that would have, you know, less inegalitarian possibilities. The other thing that the study of Latin American redistributive programs raises for us is that redistribution involves every aspect of social life. So for instance, in Chile, we have really incredible studies of, again, we can think about agrarian reform. Heidi Tinsman's book on agrarian reform in Chile highlights the fact that patriarchy was both transformed and also reconfigured actually through the agrarian reform. And that if we want to think about any kind of redistributive policy, we shouldn't be economistic about it, that actually we need to think about the way in which, for instance, the transformation of production always entails either a transformation or a reconstitution of forms of gendered and racialized power. It can involve transformations of social reproduction and so on. And so I think the study of Latin American revolution provides us with like real, not models, there's no such thing as a model that can be picked up from the past, but it shows us real times and places where, you know, the full complexity of social transformation is on display. The last thing I'll say is that when we look at redistribution in Latin America, it also should make us think carefully about the rationales we use for redistribution, on what grounds it can be defended. So for instance, I think one of the limitations actually of redistributive land reforms, even in their most effective and progressive manifestations in Latin America, was their association actually with productivity and growth. So for instance, if you look in Guatemala, the argument for redistribution, by what right does the state do this, was this is everywhere in Latin America, was the argument actually that land had a social function, and its social function was to be productive. And so if you were sitting on land, you were so rich, you didn't even need to use it, you did not have a right to it. And somebody who's going to use it deserved it. It's a powerful argument. It's a limited argument too. In Guatemala, indigenous communities, their claims to land were fundamentally grounded in a really different system of thought that said that they had historic claims to territory that they had been dispossessed of. And those were claims that couldn't necessarily be recognized. Sometimes they could be recognized under the rubric of productivity, but not always. And so when we think about, how we might pursue redistribution, we ought to sort of think about uncoupling the goal of redistribution from just the pursuit of growth. In addition to thinking about these wider questions of, what institutions would have power, decision-making power to actually implement a policy, and what are the kind of wider social transformations that we want to pursue, transformations in sort of the gender system, transformations in the racial system, and so on, that that ought to be part of our thinking, lest we simply reproduce them.
Yeah, important lessons and things we will definitely be thinking about.
Your book is Change Over Time Story. And it does. It is the sorting out of the mixed economy from, what people generally call the New Deal order to neoliberalism, but it's a very complicated story of much more continuity than one would imagine. It's decentralized public-private partnerships sort of all the way down. It's the question is what form they take, and the particularities involved in that are really, really important. Like you were saying, who does the land redistribution policy? Huge. So if that's true, then how should we think about politics today and what kind of form of the state we want? If these kind of like large concepts like neoliberalism or New Deal statism are more blurry than we imagine.
Well, I try to offer a couple thoughts on this at the end of the book. I still think that the concept of neoliberalism has tremendous power. It has power in a lot of different ways. So for instance, I learn a lot from and appreciate a lot of writing where, authors who write on neoliberalism very frequently start off their book by giving a definition of what they mean by it. And what they do is sort of meeting up the concept, but in a way that can teach us a lot, that if we think about it in one, according to one definition, then we can learn something extremely important about the world we live in and about the past. And I think that that's an absolutely legitimate way to study neoliberalism, say as a particular intellectual tradition or as a particular political economic order. There's a lot of definitions of it, and I think that they all can teach us something. One of the ways that I think neoliberalism actually has value is to think about the way that it functions in the world. And it functions as an epithet. It functions as a very, very meaningful epithet. I think when on the left, when people decry neoliberalism, and I count myself among people who was completely shaped by this, this use of the term, what they're doing is identifying the features, very often they're identifying the particular features of contemporary capitalism that they want to destroy, that they find unjust. And that can make the concept, kind of messy. And, as my book shows, it means that actually there's a whole bunch of things that get labeled as neoliberal and imagined as like very recent inventions that are actually really long and enduring features of capitalism and need to be kind of attacked in a maybe more thoroughgoing way. But it's it is nevertheless a powerful way of indicating that there is kind of there are certain kind of like reigning forms of common sense today, and that there are a set of kind of interrelated policies and practices that do in fact interrelate today that we should recognize as having some like systemic connection to one another. And that can be politicizing for people, and it can be politically mobilizing. And I have no complaint about that. And I actually think that historians shouldn't be so angry about the fact that neoliberalism is a very messy concept. Historians are used to studying messy concepts. We do it all the time. It's like the project of intellectual history. We look back at concepts like liberalism. There's no messier concept than that, right? But we recognize that it was an actor's term. It was a term of its time that was immensely meaningful to people through their either identification with it, through their pillaring of others with that term. We don't think it's a problem that that was a messy term. We take that as something to analyze. What did it mean to people and why did it organize politics so effectively actually in certain moments? Neoliberalism is a term of our time that serves exactly those functions. So at the end of the book, I try and explain actually that that's the way I think about neoliberalism. We, because we are living in this time, we do not yet have a vocabulary to analyze our own experience without that term. And so I think we just have to accept that, like, we live in our moment and we participate in it. And so we can think about it as a messy term. We can also use it because what else are you going to say? The other thing I try to do at the end of the book then is to think about, given that we are living in some kind of a neoliberal order, what we might do with our knowledge of the fact that neoliberalism is actually kind of composed of repurposed and reimagined elements of the past, as well as some kind of novel features of the present. And I think that, you know, there are people with different kinds of political temperaments, and I think they're both useful, and I think they both have a place. One political temperament is to say, all right, well, let us look around the world and find within our moment, actually, what are inevitably must be seeds of some different future. If every political economic order comes undone through a sorting, essentially, of its elements, right? If everything we think of from the age of revolutions to the era of slave emancipation, like, societies are remade by kind of destroying, you know, one or two defining elements of a world, but then breathing new life into others, then we must be also living in a moment where there's something in our existing environment that could be the seed of something else. And there are some people who work politically this way, who like really deeply invest themselves in developing institutions in the present day that they think might be able to live in this moment, but could actually portend a different future. And then there's other, you know, a different political sensibility that says we may not be able to actually, in a self-conscious manner, pick up an economic experiment of our time and see that it, you know, becomes the kind of like ingredient of the seed of some other order. Processes of political and social conflict determine actually the process by which social orders get sorted, and it may not be within our power. And so actually what we can best do is politicize and fight the sort of crucial sources of injustice in our society. And in that sense, I think that this book might alert people to actually some of the really enduring problems in capitalist economies and things that we would not want to return to actually about the mid-century order. The fact that capitalist states have so persistently pursued very austere forms of social welfare provision that push costs and risks onto recipients, onto people who have the least ability to pay, that try to avoid redistribution by squeezing essentially like more unpaid labor and you know, volunteer mobilization, and by kind of lowering costs of services. I think that that's a really long-standing feature of welfare and developmental states, and it's something that we need to really take aim at politically and not let it just be thought of as a purely neoliberal problem, but actually as a much more enduring problem. Likewise, the sort of systematic ways in which capital grows through its relationship with the state, the systematic ways in which actually we've produced states that can hardly function except through capital. That's a very long-term persistent problem that needs to be politicized, I think. So I think that this book offers, you know, different ways of thinking about problems that could be politicized differently, right? That could be portrayed not just as a recent pathology of the right, but actually as deeper systemic problems that should cause us actually then to think so much more ambitiously about the political economic future than anything that was really attempted actually in the mid-20th century in capitalist societies modeled on the mixed economy.
Before we leave you, is there anything else that you're working on right now that that we can tease listeners with? What should the world be looking for from Amy Offner?
Well, to the extent that anyone is working on anything during COVID, I am working on two projects. One is a history of debt among Native Americans in the United States in the 20th century. And second is a project that's called The Disappearing Worker. And this is a, it's sort of a transnational history of the unraveling of the employment relationship. How is it that today nobody has a legally recognizable employment relationship? Everybody's, you know, they're contracted out, or they are working for a holding company, or they're a gig worker and they're not classified as employee, and so on and so forth. And I'm sort of interested in looking at the mid-century third world as actually a proving ground where multinational corporations that were facing political mobilization, that were facing unionization, that were facing also rival mobilizations from attempts to form national capitalist classes, began to recognize the liabilities in being the boss and in directly, you know, owning plant and equipment and managing workers. And we're looking for ways to accumulate capital without the risks and responsibilities that were traditionally associated with management and employment. And I'm looking at some examples, basically, of forms of corporate restructuring that are worked out in the mid-century third world that then could be adapted and transformed in the first world as perceptions of crisis move northward after the 1970s. So those are the two projects that I'm working on now.
Thanks, Amy, for your time and sharing your knowledge with us.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Reviving Growth Keynesianism is produced by me, Nick Johnson. The podcast is supported financially by the University of Chicago Program for Professional Advancement and Training for Humanists and Humanistic Social Scientists. If you enjoyed this discussion, please follow us wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and consider leaving us a positive review, which will help us connect with more engaged listeners like you. More information on our ideas can be found at revivinggrowthkeynesianism.org. There you can also find our Patreon. We would greatly appreciate if you chose to support us. All donations allow us to put out more content for thoughtful listeners like you. Thank you for listening. We'll see you next time.